You're listening to LawPod UK. It's a podcast brought to you by the barristers of One Crown Office Row, and it covers all aspects of civil and public law in the UK. All comments are current at the time of publication, and this episode is presented by me, Lucy McCann. The Employment Rights Bill, described as the biggest overhaul of workers' rights in a generation, has been steadily working its way through Parliament since October 2024. Last-minute amendments to the bill, which would change the law on NDAs, have caused a stir. Approved by the House of Lords over the summer and being reviewed by the Commons this September, Clause 22A to the Employment Rights Bill would ban employers from using NDAs in cases of harassment and discrimination. With me to discuss the law and NDAs, whistleblowing, and what the future might look like were Clause 22A to become law, are campaigner Zelda Perkins and barrister Emma Darlow-Stern. Zelda is the founder and CEO of the campaign Can't Buy My Silence UK. Zelda was personal assistant to Harvey Weinstein and signed an NDA that prevented her from talking about his now infamous behaviour. Zelda broke her NDA in 2017, leading to a swell in the global Me Too movement. Since then, Zelda has spearheaded what is self-described as the campaign committed to end the misuse of NDAs to buy a victim's silence. Can't Buy My Silence has been instrumental in bringing about legislative change in Ireland, Canada, and the UK. Welcome, Zelda.
Thanks for having me.
Joining Zelda is Emma Darlow-Stern, a barrister at Cloisters Chambers who specialises in employment and discrimination law. As part of her practice, Emma has negotiated many settlements on behalf of both workers and employers in which confidentiality clauses have featured. In Emma's previous role as a senior legal advisor for the whistleblowing charity Protect, Emma and Zelda collaborated to produce videos making the law on NDAs and whistleblowing more accessible. Welcome, Emma.
Pleasure to be here.
Zelda, before talking about Clause 22A, which must feel like a major milestone for your campaign, I'd like to turn back to talk about your experience with an NDA. So in 1998, you left your employment as a personal assistant to Harvey Weinstein and signed an NDA. Can you tell us how that came about?
Sure. I had been working at Miramax in the UK and for Harvey for about 4 or 5 years, and I gained my own assistant. And the first time that I left her alone with Harvey, he sexually assaulted her. I had warned her, and in fact warned everybody who came to interview to take up the role with Harvey, that he had an awful temper, that he would be inappropriate. I didn't know the word sexual harassment, I have to say, at that time. I was only 24. I don't think we really knew what sexual harassment was. It was fairly normalised that men were inappropriate all the time. And actually, the biggest fear around Harvey was his temper, for those of us who work for him, rather than the kind of sexual misconduct, as we'd now define it. However, I had managed to always deal with his behaviour very robustly. And when my colleague came to me and told me that he had actually physically assaulted her, I was completely and utterly horrified and felt obviously very responsible for leaving a young woman in a room on her own with somebody who then assaulted her. We were in Venice at the Venice Film Festival, which means, to add to the being somewhere out of, you know, UK law jurisdiction, we were also on the Lido, which is a smaller island beside Venice. So we were in a very isolated position. You know, there wasn't a police station we could go to. My colleague was in terrible shock and wasn't ready to report this necessarily to the police. This was her dream job. It was the second time she'd ever met Harvey. Anyway, to me, it was very clear that this was done now, because as far as I was concerned, a criminal act had happened. A line had been crossed, and I made sure that she never went into a room with him again. And we returned to the UK, and we didn't have an HR department in the Miramax London offices. So I went to my direct female superior, who said, "You better get yourself a good lawyer," which was my first shock, because she wasn't that surprised by my revelation. And I then, having never dealt with the law on any level, I literally looked in Yellow Pages and found the closest lawyer to us in Soho, which was Simons, Muirhead & Burton. and went to speak to them, and the enormity of the situation was really revealed to me, but on several different levels. Firstly, that I had also been suffering criminal conduct in terms of my work environment and the experiences I'd had with Harvey, which made me feel pretty stupid. But again, we didn't have anybody telling us that this behaviour wasn't normal. And secondly, I was disavowed very quickly of any idea that I would have any real access to justice, that certainly my colleague had any access to justice. And we were told our only route was to negotiate a damages settlement. I was very adamant from the start that money shouldn't change hands, because for me that meant that the entire relevance or issue would completely change if, you know, when money was involved. But I was told very clearly that if I wanted to bring in some of the other requirements that we had come up with, which were things like Harvey couldn't travel with a female assistant alone, that he had to go to therapy, that there had to be a new HR policy brought into the company, etc. If we wanted to negotiate those things, the way it started was by making a monetary demand.
Mm.
And we weren't given a choice in that. We were just told, no, no, you make a monetary demand, that's what you do. And if you try to go to court, you will be destroyed. And I'm not saying that they gave us the wrong advice. However, it is unethical and immoral advice, you know, a situation, essentially.
Yeah.
We ended up going into a very frightening and grueling negotiation process over this damages settlement with Allen & Overy, who, as you know, are a Magic Circle law firm that Harvey had employed alongside his Miramax lawyers. And I think, and I've used this before, and I feel ashamed using this term, but I honestly, at 23 and 24, which both of us young women were at the time, this was the reality of our experience. It was akin to legal waterboarding.
Mm-hmm.
We were sort of smuggled into the Allen & Overy offices after hours, generally. We were kept in a room with no windows. We weren't allowed pen and paper. We had to be escorted to the loo. We certainly weren't allowed our mobile phones. We were made to feel like criminals. We were made to feel like we were causing a really major problem. And to add to that, there was very, very aggressive negotiations. As we all know, what happens in legal negotiations can get quite academic and quite aggressive. And if you've never had any experience as a layperson, that is really very, very, very discombobulating and frightening. On one occasion, we were brought into the offices. We'd had a midday session, and then we came back at 5 in the afternoon, and we were there until 5 the following morning.
Wow.
Now, at no point did our own lawyers pull the plug on this. And so, you know, for me, this whole process was actually the bigger trauma. You know, Harvey's behaviour was shocking and horrifying, but it was the weakness of human nature, I guess. And I think I had grown up very much believing in the pillars of the British justice system. And I was so shocked and completely broken by the fact that I discovered very quickly that justice was not accessible. And I was a middle-class, privileged girl. And the realization of that, and that actually it was purely about money and power, and that money and power could buy justice, was the biggest, most heartbreaking experience of my life. And signing that agreement for both my colleague and I catastrophically changed the courses of our lives in a way that is hard to define, apart from like it was an invisible nuclear explosion in our lives, because it was a nuclear explosion that we could not share with anybody, not our friends, not our family, not a new employer. We were not allowed to speak about anything. Not even to a doctor, not even to the HMRC, not even to the police. Obviously, it didn't say you cannot speak to the police. It said you have to use your best endeavours to not aid the police. And meanwhile, we had very good counsel. You know, we had a perfectly respectable law firm, and we had counsel from a highly regarded human rights law firm. You know, we had a QC there. And at no point did any legal person during those negotiations suggest or tell us that the majority of the clauses in our agreement would be unenforceable.
Yeah, so you've described one aspect of the NDA being about using best endeavours not to aid the police. Can you explain to us what was the scope of the NDA? So what was the kind of nature of the agreement that you signed?
So we weren't allowed to refer ever to the company or to any of the individuals in the company, including Harvey or his brother, which obviously is quite a handicap if you're moving into trying to get another job at some point in your life. We were both young women at the beginning of our careers. You know, I'd had a very successful 4.5 years at Miramax. And so, you know, would have had quite a good CV, essentially. We were not allowed to speak about any of our time at Miramax. We were not allowed to speak to, as I said, friends, family, media that had been designed or yet to be designed in the universe. I mean, it was highly neurotic, this agreement. But, you know, it made it terrifying to us. And we were told that if any civil or criminal action, you know, we were approached by a lawyer or by the police, that we had to use our best endeavours not to aid them. If we had to aid them, we had to give 48 hours warning to Miramax and to Allen and Overy, and that we still had to use our best endeavours, even if we aided them, never to identify Harvey or Miramax. I mean, the point of all of this is, I mean, it's all pretty nonsensical. And as lawyers, you'll know, you know, this isn't enforceable. But as a lay person, these are terrifying terms. And our lawyers said to us at the end of the negotiations, basically, you have to imagine that this period of your life is a black hole that you can never speak about. Now, it is the action of those words. It is what you come away believing those words to mean that have the power. And I know we're talking about 25 years ago, but I speak to people and I'm still speaking to people. And particularly there's been a big influx since the potential law change, where I'm seeing employees entering into, being asked to enter into non-disclosure agreements, which are generally just normal employment settlement agreements, which have similar actions, the similar threat. And these people are terrified. And I think the difficulty is the translation between the legal sector and those who practice law, understanding the kind of mystical power that the word of law, which nobody really understands because legalese is almost impossible to understand unless you learn about it, how much power that holds over somebody. And if an agreement says, we will sue you for £1 million if you break this, that's all you see and hear and believe. The fact that it is unenforceable if you actually went to court is totally irrelevant. Because the reality that you as a victim with no money, you know, who's a junior person, or maybe not even a junior person, but somebody who is definitely in a power disparity in the relationship, the likelihood that you are going to test this in court is pretty much a zero. I mean, the percentage is so tiny. And this is what the legal profession, I'm afraid, and unscrupulous employers have relied on. And it has sort of grown insidiously over the last 40, 50 years to a point where it is now standard. And I'd like to remind everyone, standard is not a legal term. When your lawyer says, this is standard, you just sign this because this is what everybody signs. Well, of course, normal person goes, okay, I have to sign this because it's standard. These are the rules. So, you know, for me, this has always been about the integrity of law. I still have this naive and deep belief in the fact that law should be doing the right thing and is upholding justice and is upholding the duty of the court. And it is not about buying the smartest, wiliest lawyer to get whatever you want. And that's what broke me during that process, was seeing that it wasn't to do with right and wrong. It was to do with money and power. And ultimately, our sycophancy to money and power should not be served in the legal sector. And it is. I mean, when I approached my lawyer who had represented me back in the 90s, you know, there was part of them that was very proud of the agreement that they had negotiated. And they said to me, I have never got so much for a client before or since. I've never had to negotiate so hard. But also that's the rub, because we got all these incredible clauses in the agreement, you know, provisions that were meant to make Harvey go to therapy, that meant that if he made a settlement in the ensuing 4 years, that it had to be shown to Disney, who were the parent company, or he would be fired. You know, we put in all these amazing clauses, but did they take any notice of them? Did Miramax take any notice of them? Did Harvey? Of course not. However, me and my colleague were buried under a stone, and our lives as young 20-something professionals were halted. I moved to South America because I couldn't speak, and I'm a terrible chatterbox, as you're already seeing. I think I only managed to put in twice.
But in 2017, you broke your NDA. You went to the New York Times, and this ultimately led to Harvey Weinstein's imprisonment, didn't it? So what led you to make that decision a number of years after you signed your NDA?
I had tried to break it several times. And in fact, I did break it in 2013 with Ken Arletta at The New Yorker. I don't know if you've seen the film She Said or read the book or were following the press in 2013, but a model ended up being assaulted by Harvey, Amber Bretliana Gutierrez, and she went to the police and they sent her back to Harvey with a wire. And that wire recording is actually played in the film, She Said. And it's a very, very powerful thing to listen to. And I happened to be working in New York at that very moment. And I was approached by Ken Arletta, who had tried to speak to me over the years. And I'd always been too scared to speak to him. And he told me what had happened. And he said, we've got Harvey. You know, he's been tapped. So I went and met Ken Arletta and I told him everything. And 4 days later, the story disappeared. Amber was paid off. The NYPD buried the tape. The district attorney buried the tape. And I remember going to my boss and breaking down in tears. He didn't know what was going on, but I was like, you know, the British legal system let me down in 98. The lawyers aren't going to get him. And now the NYPD and the district attorney of New York City are also being bought off. This is never, ever, ever going to get opened up. So when the New York Times came to me in 2017, I basically had already kind of let the story go. And I think at that point, I was so angry and so disillusioned. And I think beginning to realize the impact that it had had on my life and was having on my life, because people were now beginning to come forward to speak about Harvey, but it hadn't burst yet. It was just beginning to happen. And I realized that this, for me, was a massively important moment, because I didn't want everyone to be distracted by the ogre, which was Weinstein. The real ogre, the real danger, the real horror was the fact that law protects these people. They are legitimately protected. They continue to behave with impunity, and victims are re-victimized daily, hourly, by the minute, by having their voices removed and their access to justice removed by a piece of paper that is legally binding. And for me, this was always about the system. It was never about the individual. And I think as the hysteria grew around Harvey and Me Too, I just felt that I had a massive duty and moral responsibility to expose the bigger underlying danger, because I felt like Harvey was going to be brought to justice because so many brave women were speaking up about what happened to them. And for me, that was also shattering, because I always just thought it was those of us who worked for him who he bullied. And I knew that he had affairs. You know, as someone who worked for Harvey, we were very aware that he had extramarital relationships, but we were not aware that he was raping, assaulting, abusing women. And you know, that whole story, and there were so many awful stories that came out, but they didn't need another person saying, well, Harvey did this, that, or the next thing. What was needed to be exposed was the key to why Harvey could do those things. why Epstein can do those things, why Trump can do those things, because the law protects them. The law is viable. Justice is viable, and that's not right. And the one thing we can do is change law. We cannot change human nature, but we can change law. We can improve law.
So your campaign, Can't Buy My Silence, has been hugely successful. What you've described, is that your kind of driving motivation behind that campaign? It's that system level focus on bringing about change.
Absolutely. And I think very early on, I, you know, was very fortunate with riding the wave of Me Too, and I managed to give evidence to 2 select committee inquiries. And out of that, what's now the Department for Business and Trade, which was then BEIS, did a big public consultation. And I took part in this public consultation, and it was such a shocking eye-opener to me because I only knew my own story. And I presumed that I had a really bad NDA, and my colleague had a really bad NDA, and I knew there were other ones out there, but I didn't really realise the endemic nature. I also didn't realise how every sector was completely swamped. And in the BEIS consultation, the first round table I went to, there was a corporate lawyer, there was a charity worker, there was a teacher, there was a civil servant, there was me, there was someone from hospitality. Every single one of those people recounted the same experience, and in many cases, worse than mine, because mine happened to me when I was young. I could bounce. I didn't have a mortgage to pay, school fees to pay, a husband or a wife. And these people's lives were, again, catastrophically affected. Not just their careers, not just their personal relationships, not just their mental health, but their physical health. And it was so shocking seeing that every single person in that room basically had a mental breakdown, a physical breakdown, a relationship breakdown, and career loss. All because of this one simple thing, basically a confidentiality clause in a settlement agreement. And a confidentiality clause in a settlement agreement should not be harmful. It should be there to protect. And because of what has happened, this insidious creep of the way that they've been used and weaponized, the damage just became very clear. And as the campaign really grew and I became more reachable, I just became inundated by people, and not just women, and it's not just about sexual harassment at all, from every sector, who were telling me the same story, whose words are the same. And I can tell you, if I had known and understood how big and bad and the Pandora's box I was opening, I think I would have run for the hills. But, you know, like most things, it happened by increments. And I always say I'm an accidental campaigner. But the more victims came to me and the more extraordinary ways NDAs had impacted people's lives, the more I realised that this was something that really, really had to be stopped.
So let's take a step back before we talk a bit more about NDAs. Emma, let's bring you in. When we're talking about NDAs, do you want to help us by explaining what we're actually talking about from a legal perspective?
Sure. So NDAs, or non-disclosure agreements, include confidentiality clauses whereby a party or parties to an agreement agree not to share particular information. This could be trade secrets, intellectual property, factual allegations, settlement terms, or a settlement sum, for example. NDAs also include non-disparagement clauses, which sometimes get a bit less airtime. And they're used to prevent a party or parties making or publishing disparaging or derogatory statements about each other. And these clauses often go further than defamation law. There's no reference to whether damage is caused or is likely to be caused to reputation. Whereas in defamation claims, a claimant has to get over the serious harm threshold. So they've got to establish that the relevant publication has caused or is likely to cause serious harm to their reputation before a claim can even get off the ground. And whilst NDAs can be standalone documents, they're often provisions that form part of a wider contract or agreement of some kind.
And in what context then, as an employment lawyer, do you encounter NDAs?
In the employment sphere, NDAs are typically used in three main contexts. Firstly, employment contracts to protect confidential information, intellectual property, trade secrets, as I've already mentioned. Secondly, in settlement agreements entered into upon termination of a worker's employment. So this is outside this sort of litigation realm, but particularly where there's a potentially contentious end to the working relationship. And thirdly, settlement agreements, or COT3s, entered into in the context of litigation or proposed litigation. So COT3 is a conciliation agreement facilitated by ACAS, the Advisory Conciliation and Arbitration Service, whose aim is to help resolve employment disputes without litigation. As a barrister dealing with employment and discrimination law matters, I most routinely encounter NDAs in the context of litigation. So when settling a claim, whether that's pre-issue or sometimes on the second day of trial.
So as the law currently stands, Emma, what can you agree and, I guess more importantly, not agree to keep confidential as part of a confidentiality agreement?
I think it's a really important question, and it's something that Zelda and I discussed a few years back in the whistleblowing context. The law actually prevents you from keeping quite a lot confidential. I won't give an exhaustive list. Whatever an agreement says, and there are often carve-outs from confidentiality clauses making this clear, you cannot be prevented from making a protected disclosure under Section 43A of the Employment Rights Act 1996. So whistleblowing. You can't be prevented from raising concerns that do not meet the statutory requirements of a protected disclosure, but are otherwise in the public interest. So serious misconduct, perhaps. Reporting a suspected crime to the police, reporting suspected misconduct to regulators or HMRC, complying with an order from a court or tribunal to give evidence. The list goes on. A couple of notable points, and no one person can make a law, but Zelda's certainly tried to disprove that rule. Her campaign has had a lot to do with making these changes happen. As of the 1st of August 2025, the Higher Education Freedom of Speech Act 2023 now means that higher education providers, such as universities, cannot enter into NDAs with staff, students, members, or even visiting speakers in relation to sexual abuse, sexual harassment, sexual misconduct, and other types of bullying or harassment.
You know, there are lots of quite difficult jumps and hoops that victims have to go through. And part of the point of trying to move and improve this legislation is that all of the onus is on the victim. And the victim is already in a very, very vulnerable, weakened position. They're already in a horrible power dynamic where they have less power, less money, you know, are in a much more risky position than the employer. First, they have to report. Second, they have to prove. Third, they have to then try and work out if it's in the public interest. Fourth, they then have to work out, well, is it criminal or not? They have to understand the law incredibly well. And, you know, the second prong of the campaign for Can't Buy My Silence, which ran alongside trying to make legislative change, was trying to get guidance change within the legal sector. Because again, I don't blame the solicitors or the barristers that have advised and that work in this environment, because they are following guidelines and they're very smart and they understand their guidance in a way that a layperson is not going to understand. And we have an issue, and this is something that the LSB have been looking into recently, is how lawyers behave when they are kind of in a combat situation and how their practice is affected when you've got two smart lawyers against two smart lawyers. And the fact is that what happens is the human equation, the victim, the client, generally gets forgotten. And that's human. You know, if you're in a room and you're having a really good arm wrestle with another very smart lawyer, this is an academic battle. And you often forget that at the bottom of that is a vulnerable human being who is going to have to live with the result of your fight, your legal battle, for the rest of their life. So for me, guidance around the use of NDAs and the use of confidentiality is incredibly important because I think solicitors need help there. And one of the interesting things is if you look at jurisdictions where this has been taken off the table, where confidentiality around sexual harassment, particularly in the States, which has happened in about 27 different states now, varying degrees of harassment, discrimination, etc., but the sort of leading states are California and Washington. And I was on a panel a few months ago with a lawyer from California, and she said, it's fascinating. It has made absolutely no difference. Taking that off the table has not slowed down settlements. If anything, it's speeded them up because there isn't that mechanism to kind of blackmail people with confidentiality. It hasn't made settlement amounts go down hugely. The settlement happens quicker because there's no funny business. You know, they know that they can't hide this, so they've just got to settle, and they've got to settle agreeably and properly. And actually, that speeds the process up. And a lot of employment lawyers have been very, very scared and very vociferous about the fact that if you take away confidentiality, there is no incentive for an employer to settle. And in our experience, I can't buy my silence, we see that this isn't true, but we haven't had the data until quite recently. And because America, several states have been ahead of other parts of the world in terms of legislating here, what we now have got to see is that actually settlement rates around sexual harassment have gone up by nearly 10%. Now, I think that's kind of amazing because the world has not collapsed in California and Washington. There's not like 1,000 women screaming about their sexual harassment settlements and sexual predators and this, that, and the next thing. But they have not been chilled from speaking. The NDA was what was chilling people. The confidentiality was what was chilling them from coming forward and getting a reasonable settlement for a reasonable reason. And, you know, employers aren't like suddenly also inundated with thousands and hundreds of vexatious claims about sexual harassment. You know, because actually, weirdly, that's not what happens. Victims don't do that. Of course, there's always going to be the odd vexatious claimant. But that's going to happen whatever the situation is. And the people who actually are real victims, they don't want to speak publicly. They don't necessarily want to talk to their colleagues at work. But what they don't want is they don't want to be stopped from telling their partner, their friend, their family, warning a colleague if that's what they feel they need to do. They don't want to have their voice taken away from them. They don't want to not have the option to go to therapy. And certainly in this country, if you want to go to therapy on the NHS, well, it tends to be group therapy. Well, you can't do that if you've signed an NDA. My NDA said I couldn't even speak to my own therapist. You know?
Yeah, just to come back on a couple of things that you've mentioned, Zelda. Firstly, the carve-outs or exceptions. And secondly, the lawyer's duty. And then thirdly, the effect of these amendments or proposed amendments. Firstly, carve-outs. I'm with you that the limitations of these exceptions, as it were, is that even with legal advice, it's not always wholly clear what it is you are and are not allowed to say. So reporting a suspected crime, fairly straightforward, but the conduct complained of is not always a criminal act. And even if it is, many people understandably do not want to go to the police. But taking even just the whistleblowing exception by way of example, it's a big burden on an individual to try to predict whether what they want to say is likely to be deemed by a judge to amount to protected disclosure. To fall within the framework of the notoriously complex whistleblowing legislation that beguiles even the best of us at times. And this is helped, of course, by legal advice, but it's not solved by it. Because even if I were to explain to a client the ingredients of a protected disclosure, a reasonable belief in XYZ, I cannot advise with certainty that a future disclosure will end up being protected so that by making it, that individual won't fall foul of an NDA that they've signed. So these exceptions are important, but putting them on a statutory footing, as has happened, as you've said, Zelda, common law exceptions that are now being put on a statutory footing is helpful. But it'd be even more helpful to have relevant carve-outs spelt out And this has been a side effect, or indeed a direct effect, of the SRA guidance and some of the regulatory guidance that's come about, in large part, I'm sure, due to your campaigning, Zelda, to spelling out in clear ordinary language in contracts or agreements so that non-lawyers can understand what they're signing, but also continue to understand it. So once the lawyer's gone out of the picture and you go back to that agreement you've signed, you don't then need another lawyer to explain it to you again. That's the sort of carve-outs point I wanted to make. And then the lawyer's duty, it is a tricky one because ultimately my duty is to my client. If my client says they want confidentiality clauses, if it's legal and not breaking my ethical code to argue for that for them, then I will. And I think that is just part of an element of this job. The thing that's helpful about regulatory guidance, or indeed just a change in the law, is that you can then point to, oh, have you seen the SRA warning notice? Of course, we do have to pay heed to that, etc. And I have done that. Maybe I'm a product of my time and I've obviously qualified while we've known each other, Zelda. But the way that I approach confidentiality and non-disparagement clauses has been heavily influenced by the shifting landscape on NDAs and by Zelda and her campaign. We've not always agreed on everything, but my conversations with Zelda have made me think carefully and critically about the use of NDAs on a case-by-case basis, rather than including them automatically. And in my experience, the most important thing tends to be the terms of settlement, so the settlement sum and other terms, understandably, I think, for respondent employers, and negotiation leading to that settlement. Now, keeping those things confidential is not something that claimants tend to find problematic. I've never seen it be a barrier to settlement. It's the other elements, so non-disparagement and circumstances, for example, or wider clauses, the interpretation of which is ambiguous or might lead to a chilling effect going forward.
And also, you know, just to back up what Emma's saying, I mean, confidentiality is really important and it's often requested and wanted and needed by both sides and by the victim. And, you know, it should be something that can be talked about and negotiated about. What it shouldn't be is a standard thing that is forced onto the victim and they are told that they will not get their settlement if they don't agree to speak. And I agree. To me, it's very simple. Any confidentiality that is hiding something that could cause potential harm in the future is a problem. Hiding the amount of your settlement, that's the least of my concerns.
Yeah. So we've referred a lot to Clause 22A. Shall we just quickly go over what it says and what it might mean practically? And then I want to return to this discussion that we're having about the kind of legal and cultural consequences of what that might mean, because I think that's obviously what's of most interest to everyone. But let's return to Clause 22A, the last minute amendment to the Employment Rights Bill, which is currently passing through legislative stages. So 22A, the kind of material bit of it reads as follows. So any provision in an agreement between an employer and a worker of the employer, brackets, whether a worker's contract or not, close brackets, is void insofar as it purports to preclude the worker from making A, an allegation of or a disclosure of information relating to relevant harassment or discrimination, or B, an allegation or a disclosure of information relating to the response of an employer of the worker to either relevant harassment or discrimination, or the making of an allegation or disclosure within paragraph A. So I think in very brief summary, it's largely to do with allegations surrounding harassment and discrimination, but also importantly covers how an employer responds to those allegations. So Emma, if you agree that that's a reasonably brief summary of Clause 22A, can you just help us with what this would mean if it passes in the form that we know it to be now? What this would mean practically for employers. So what the kind of change is that's intended.
Well, it's important to note that the detail and some very important detail has yet to be hashed out.
Mm.
Obviously, if Clause 22A becomes law, then employers will need to familiarise themselves with the new provisions and update their contracts or settlement agreement templates. The provisions are expected to apply to businesses of all sizes. And what amounts to a worker for these purposes again, yet to be defined, but it's intended to be wider than a LIMBY worker. So that may capture agency workers, those undertaking work experience. The actual substantive effect of Clause 22A is again a bit unclear. The relevant harassment or discrimination, bizarrely, doesn't include victimisation or failure to comply with the duty to make reasonable adjustments for disabled individuals. What it does cover is most forms of discrimination, including direct and indirect discrimination, discrimination arising from disability, and harassment related to a protected characteristic or sexual harassment. But it's not clear why those other two causes of action are left out.
So I found that quite interesting because it seemed quite artificial to distinguish between harassment and discrimination and, for example, victimisation. And I wonder how lawyers are going to work around that. If, for example, you're making allegations of harassment, discrimination and victimisation that all stem from the same facts.
I think what may end up happening, and obviously often in ET claims, employment tribunal claims, there are lots of overlapping allegations bundled together that cover the same factual matrix. And for employers, this may mean, and indeed for everyone, that the side effect of Clause 22A is that lots of other claims will also be caught indirectly, and confidentiality and non-disparagement clauses may simply just stop being used more generally, because it's going to be quite difficult or maybe not cost-effective to have separate provisions in the same settlement agreement drafted for separate claims when the underlying facts could be labelled as victimisation or whistleblowing or harassment or all of the above, or indeed unfair dismissal or something that's not covered at all by these clauses or by existing carve-outs. So it's unclear what's actually going to happen, but it could have more far-reaching consequences than perhaps expected. I mean, the other important thing I was going to mention is the response of an employer. So at the moment, Clause 22A renders void any provision that purports to preclude a worker from making an allegation or a disclosure of information relating to the response of an employer, as well as simply relating to relevant harassment or discrimination. What is encompassed by the response of an employer? If this is how they've handled allegations or even acts of harassment, that makes sense to me. Would it, however, encompass the act of settling and the term settled for? That would go further, in my view, than it needs to go. But a lot will come down to that. The other major point is exemptions. So these have yet to be defined. Circumstances in which confidentiality can be agreed, likely at the complainant's behest and with proper legal advice, being one of them. For employers, this could mean that if they would like confidentiality over a Clause 22A type allegation or disclosure, then they will need to pay for the worker to have legal advice. So it may end up meaning that more claims are settled by way of settlement agreement or even by COT 3, but with legal advice there, which is obviously an added cost. But in terms of understanding what's being agreed, from an access to justice point of view, it's got its positives, I think, because a lot of the issue comes from not knowing what you're signing.
Yeah. So with all that in mind, Emma, do you think that Clause 22A is a positive shift?
This is the key question. Judging by LinkedIn, which for its sins is a fairly good litmus test of these things, I'm more optimistic than most employment lawyers. I think we're perhaps further than we think we are already. And what used to be par for the course regarding NDAs is now far from default. I think it may be a good idea. I stress maybe, because as I've just outlined, a lot of important detail is yet to be determined. Two key unknowns that give me pause for thought are what's meant by the response of an employer, as I've just mentioned, and what are the exemptions? Assuming those go, broadly speaking, the way that I would hope that they go, so response of an employer doesn't include settlement sums, settlement terms, negotiations. It's just about how they've handled the allegations or the original act of harassment, for example. I don't see the strong policy need to keep some, etc., confidential. And second, that the exemptions allow for workers to request confidentiality, subject to defined carve-outs, and provided they've had that legal advice. assuming those things go the way they should, I think it may be a good idea. And for all the reasons that Zelda's outlined, but just in short, the massive policy reason for these changes is essentially, if we're aiming for a more open and transparent workplace where misconduct and harassment are not tolerated, in which people feel able to speak up and feel, crucially, that their concerns will be properly handled, investigated when they do, Clause 22A goes a long way towards achieving those aims. And just to address what is, again, judging by LinkedIn, a major concern, and I understand is a major concern, which is, although Clause 22A may disincentivize harmful behavior or an action in response to that behavior, will it also disincentivize settlement? Will the unwelcome side effect be that more workers have to go through the time, the cost, the stress of litigation to reach a resolution? I'm not that concerned about that. And I'm not that concerned about that because, although obviously avoiding reputational risk is a major incentive for employers to settle claims, firstly, there are other incentives to settle, notwithstanding the position on confidentiality. The commercial, the legal costs, the disruption to the business and respondent witnesses of long public hearings. Secondly, there's often no point in trying to keep confidential the actual facts or allegations of a case, particularly in the context of litigation in our current underfunded system, where by the time settlement is being looked at, the cat is well and truly out of the bag. It's been running around in the neighbours' gardens for a couple of years, particularly when hearings are listed so far into the future that you've got a couple of years before a case is heard. And thirdly, and this is often overlooked in my view, there's an important qualitative difference in terms of reputational impact between an allegation made by a worker to friends, to colleagues, even publicly on social media, and witness evidence tested publicly in a court or tribunal, adverse findings of fact made by a judge or a panel, or an adverse public judgment, all of which can be fairly safely reported by the mainstream press. Baseless allegations without substance are very unlikely to be reported by the media for the obvious libel risks. However, reportage, so neutral reporting of attributed allegations, can and is done. So there's still a lot to be gained by settling without confidentiality, in my view.
Yeah, I agree. And the Noel Clark case recently is a kind of case in point on that. I think it's much more damaging to have a judge make a finding that's published and people are going to pay more attention to that than, as you say, people just posting things on their Instagram and TikTok.
Absolutely. And Mrs. Justice Stein in that case took pains to praise, and in part this was because it was one of the issues, the public interest defence, the truth defence, but praised the extensive efforts of the journalists and the editors of The Guardian to investigate, to test, to corroborate the information they received, and not to publish allegations which they could not substantiate.
Mm. So Zelda, you've heard what Emma's had to say and what she thinks the impact of Clause 22A is going to be. To what extent do you think Clause 22A is going to achieve the sort of campaign aim of Can't Buy My Silence?
Well, you know, there are some additions that I would like to make, which obviously have come from conversations that I've been having with the government. And obviously, I don't mean that this is definitely going to happen, but certainly, you know, what's on the face of the bill, which is what Emma's been talking about, is quite clear and has impacts that we may or may not see that Emma's spoken about. But what Justin Madders and Angela Rayner have been very, very clear about is that the intention of the bill is absolutely to stick to the red lines that we of a campaign have been pushing for in terms of what an accepted NDA would be. So that's obviously independent legal advice is provided, that non-disparagement, which we know because that's actually in the face of the bill, but that was one of our big red lines, non-disparagement is treated the same, you know, with the definition of an NDA, that confidentiality is of a limited duration with option for victim to waive their own confidentiality when they desire, that it has to be at the request of the victim so that there's no undue attempt to influence the victim to sign confidentiality. Now, those as legal practitioners, you understand how important that is, but it's also, there are some subtle things in there, you know, so the Washington state law the employer is not allowed to request or suggest confidentiality. And that's what we're pushing for here too. I don't have the answers about that, but I do have still, unbelievably, a huge amount of trust and admiration and belief in legal practitioners' ability to do incredible things. And I know that once they get off this slight track that they're on at the moment, where they think that victims aren't going to get to settle, which is not going to be the case, all this is about is changing the power disparity and giving victims more ability to negotiate in their settlement. And we can see from other jurisdictions abroad that this is a positive thing for victims and that settlement has gone up. And I think once law practitioners have kind of got on board with that and moved their track to this way, I think this is going to be an extraordinary piece of law. And I think it'll be a globally leading piece of law. So let's all actually look at how we make what the government is offering into a really brilliant watertight piece of law that protects the vulnerable, that puts some parity in bargaining, and that means that the law is not being used and weaponized abusively and unethically to protect perpetrators.
Zelda, let's hope then that Clause 22A in its final form lives up to all of your expectations. Even if it does, and let's hope it does, what's next for the campaign? Are you done? Will you ever stop campaigning?
What campaign? We're done. We've won. No. Yeah, it's a very good question. I mean, there's still a lot of work to be done on this piece of legislation. And, you know, we're very fortunate to be being involved very closely in the consultation process and hopefully bringing forward lots of stakeholders to really look at this. There is a place for the campaign to continue ad infinitum, I'm sure. But I have to say, on a personal front right now, this has been 7 years of a fight that I wasn't expecting. I have used every piece of my brain that I didn't know I had or had or wish I had in getting to this point, and it's given me a huge amount of faith in democracy. And yes, the levers are hard to pull and the buttons are sticky, but if you have the tenacity and the ability, and I think that does generally come from personal experience, then it does work. And if we can make the law a little bit better, even by a small increment, then I feel I have done my job. But as I say, this has been 7 years of a fight, but it's been 30 years of an enormous weight sitting on my very being. And I'm just coming to grips with how it feels not to be carrying that 10-ton sack, not carrying all the people who've come to me. So right at this very, very minute, and we're only a month down the line from this being announced, I basically want to run for the hills. But I have a feeling that there will be a lot still to do once I have rebalanced myself. We shall see. There's certainly need for the advice and support that the campaign gives. And this is not retrospective, this piece of legislation. And there are still people who need to be heard, who need to be understood, who need to share their testimonies, who need to be given confidence that they can maybe speak to their family and the people they need to, even if that is breaking their NDA, because the environment is changing. So I think, you know, there is a role to be played. But yeah, for the next few weeks, I just want to be on a beach with a pina colada.
So you should be.
Yeah, the future does look a little brighter, and we are just hugely indebted to you and your campaign for that, really, Zelda. You really do deserve the biggest holiday, especially somewhere on a very warm beach. I think I'll leave things there on that positive note. Thank you so much, both of you, for coming on the pod. I'm incredibly grateful to both of you, and especially you, Zelda, for sharing your story with us, which I'm sure our listeners will agree is incredibly moving and very powerful. Thank you so much, both of you, for coming on.
Thanks, Lucy.
Thanks.